Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program, brought to you from the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto. My name is Allison Van Diggelen. It's my pleasure to introduce Mark Tursek, President and CEO of the Nature Conservancy and author of Nature's Fortune, How Business and Society Can Thrive by Investing in Nature. Mark is a former managing director and partner at Goldman Sachs, where he oversaw several departments, including corporate finance, equity capital markets, and Pine Street, the firm's leadership development. During his 24-year career, Mark was also tasked to develop the firm's environmental strategy and lead its environmental markets group. Last year, following Superstorm Sandy, Mark was appointed by New York Governor Andrew Cuomo to serve on the state's 2100 Commission to improve infrastructure and mitigate damages from future storms. He's a member of several boards, including the Resources for the Future, the Nicholas Institute for Environmental Policy Solutions, and the Commission on Climate and Tropical Forest. Mark graduated from Williams College and earned his MBA from Harvard University. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Mark Tursek.
Thank you, Allison, and thanks everybody for being here. It's a pleasure to be here. Well, when I joined the Nature Conservancy now 5 years ago, I thought it made a lot of sense, all the sense in the world, for the Nature Conservancy to hire someone like me with a background on Wall Street as an investment banker. But when I joined the organization and got into the environmental movement on a full-time basis, I learned not everybody thought the same way. I remember one event in particular in my early days on the job in Washington, D.C. It was a big event of many important people in the environmental movement. All of the congressmen and congresswomen and senators who really had ambitious environmental agendas were there. The heads of the important agencies, agriculture and interior, those cabinet members were there. The heads of the foundations that organizations like the Nature Conservancy really rely on for funding, the big foundations with ambitious environmental programs were there, and my counterparts, the other CEOs of environmental nonprofits. So to be honest, it was a little bit intimidating. And I remember kind of scanning the crowd, and one guest in particular really stood out, an older gentleman. He looked like he was in his 80s, in fact, but he was very, very fit, well-dressed, and I could see he commanded a lot of respect. Everybody was paying very close attention to him. And it dawned on me, he must have been Russell Train. Now, all of you won't know who Russell Train is, but Russell, he passed away about a year ago in his 90s. Russell Train was a giant in our field. He was the first chairman of the President's Council on Environmental Quality. He was the second head of the Environmental Protection Agency. He was a founder of the World Wildlife Fund and the Conservation Fund. I could go on and on and on. It's hard to imagine how accomplished one person could be in this field. So I thought I better go up to Mr. Train and introduce myself. So I did. I introduced myself. I explained who I was, what my background was. And then Mr. Train, really, he stood back like this, looked me up and down. Then he looked me in the eye, and he said, rather gruffly, but not unkindly, "How the hell did you get from Goldman Sachs to leading the Nature Conservancy?" To be honest, I sort of was flat on my feet and didn't really have a very good answer. But what I should have told him is what I'm going to tell you tonight. What I should have said to Mr. Train was, first, as great as the environmental movement is, we need to take it to new levels, and so we should be open to new leaders and new ideas, and so it makes sense for some newcomers like me to be in the field. Second, this notion that I write about in the book, this notion of investing in nature, kind of a natural argument for a former investment banker to make, has some really important, I think, opportunities. And third, strategies like that can do some really important things for the environmental movement, and namely get more people on our side, more financial resources on our side, and improve how environmentalists engage with the rest of society. So that's what I want to talk about tonight, and I'll give you a couple of examples to illustrate what I mean, and I'll try not to go on at too great length so we can have some back and forth Q&A, okay? So first, where are we in the environmental movement? I remember the day I learned I got the job at the Nature Conservancy. It was the most exciting day in my professional career. I couldn't have more respect for the environmental movement. Back when I worked on Wall Street, I was a donor. I volunteered. My last job at Goldman was as an environmentalist. I think the world of the environmental movement. That was even before I joined. Now that I've joined, I feel even more strongly. At the Nature Conservancy, my organization, we're just one of many great environmental nonprofits, but TNC is an extraordinary outfit. 4,000 people, 600 scientists operating in every one of the 50 states, some 35 additional countries, 60-plus years of experience, incredible knack for deal-doing, and we're just one of many great environmental organizations. All of us have great staffs, great strategies, and we're supported by extraordinary volunteer leaders and donors, like people like you. The environmental movement is great. However, in my view, if you're an environmentalist, you also have to look at the facts. At TNC, we say we're a science-based organization, so that really means looking at the facts. And I think if you look at the facts, it shows that we environmentalists aren't really getting the job done. You could say we're winning lots of battles, but losing the war. And why do I say that? Imagine if you had my job. Imagine if you were the head of the Nature Conservancy. What kinds of things would you like to see more of? It's a no-brainer, right? You'd like to see a more healthy forest, stronger fisheries, better topsoil, better clean water supplies, healthier coral reefs, more biodiversity itself. I could go on and on. Well, we measure all these things. And sadly, notwithstanding all of the environmental movement's great efforts, these things are all in steady decline. Or you might think about the things that we would like to have less of. Take greenhouse gas emissions, for example. Well, once again, notwithstanding all the great efforts of environmentalists and their supporters, we set globally, year after year, new record highs in greenhouse gas emissions. So somehow we've got to get more done. We're not really getting the job done. And when we look forward, it's not going to get any easier. For example, we all know the world's population is growing. More significantly, in this sense, the world's middle class is growing. The population will grow from 7 to 9 billion or more by 2050. The middle class will grow at an even faster rate. Now, at the Nature Conservancy, we don't think that's a bad thing, the rise of the middle class. That means people are being lifted out of poverty. And those aren't just nice words to say. That means families will have better roofs over their homes, better educational alternatives for their children, better access to energy and food. These are good things. But as these people enter the middle class, that'll also mean more demand for food, space, energy, and water. And with that will go a lot of built infrastructure. And all of that is a threat to the natural systems that we want to protect. And if that's not enough for you, you have to factor climate change in on top of that, which is only going to exacerbate our challenges. So, to me, it's a no-brainer. Environmentalists somehow have to scale up their work, get more done, have a bigger impact. So that would have been the first part of my answer to Russell Train. The environmental movement is very strong, but it also needs new strategies, new leaders. We've got to try new initiatives to get more done. The next thing I would have said is, a former investment banker, not so crazy, because this notion of investing in nature, I think, can really help us address a lot of our challenges. Not all of them. I don't claim that this is the killer strategy that addresses everything, but I do believe, and that's what the book is about, that in case after case, instance after instance, an investment orientation can get a lot done. Now, what do I mean by that? What I mean is, environmentalists sometimes, I love environmentalists, we sometimes get so excited about our work we lose the bigger audience. We talk about saving nature as a moral imperative. We think saving nature is the right thing to do. We owe our children and our grandchildren natural systems as healthy as the ones we enjoy. That's what I think. That's what my colleagues at the Nature Conservancy think. But some people, many people, when they hear that, they mistakenly think of nature as a luxury good, something that's nice to invest in when times are good, something that's appropriate for the very well-off to be concerned with. But when times are bad, or for poorer countries or poorer people, nature is a luxury. Well, I think that's exactly wrong. And when I think about nature as an investor, I think instead of nature as the underpinning of human well-being. Think of nature as an asset, or more specifically as infrastructure. We can call it green infrastructure. Green infrastructure in order to contrast it with gray infrastructure, that is man-made infrastructure. Well, what does green infrastructure do for you? Well, it provides us clean air to breathe, healthy water to drink, food and fish to eat, topsoil to grow our foods, forests to protect us from floods and storms, and so on and so on. And so as an investor in nature, I argue we should look for those opportunities, good deal opportunities, to put money to work, to invest in nature, to obtain those benefits. Academics and environmentalists call those benefits ecosystem services. But that's what I mean by investing in nature. And when we talk about investing in nature, and this would be the third part of my answer to Russell Train, a couple of things happen. First, to me it's obvious, we need more people on the side of environmentalists. Well, I think investing in nature can get us those people. Environmentalists, like me, are very good at preaching to the choir. And by choir, I mean people who support us. We love our choir at the Nature Conservancy. We think our choir are the world's very best people. But it's too small a portion of the population. Environmentalists are also pretty good at going after bad guys. That's not so much the focus of our work at TNC, but that's also important. So we're good at talking to the choir. We're good at going after the bad guys, but we're leaving everyone else out. But I think when we talk about investing in nature and the practical benefits of protecting nature, we can get more people on our side. Second, I think we can get more financial resources on our side. Protecting nature takes some wherewithal. Environmentalists to date have mostly gotten things done thanks to our very generous donors. It's extraordinary to me what our individual donors contribute and what that allows us to do. We've also benefited from great partnerships with government. But our resources are insufficient to get our job done. But when we talk about investing in nature as an investment opportunity and show opportunity after opportunity to save money and to earn high returns, I think we can get more resources behind us. And the third benefit of investing in nature is it changes the nature of the dialogue between environmentalists and everybody else. I think, again, sometimes we environmentalists, we have room for improvement here. We get so caught up in our work, we're so enthused, we believe so strongly that we're doing the right thing, that we sometimes get a bit carried away and we kind of lecture and even yell at people, telling them, you should do this and you should do that. Well, with a few years under my belt now, I've come to understand that people don't really want to be lectured at by me. But when we talk about investing in nature, a different kind of dialogue results. And it's more one where we listen to other people, other parts of society. We try to understand what they're trying to accomplish. And then we collaboratively determine whether an investment in nature might provide some practical benefit that people are seeking. So that's kind of how I should have answered Russell Train. That's what my book's about. Let me give you a few examples so you know what I'm talking about, okay? Now, the book is full of these examples, but I'll just do a couple in the interest of time. First one takes place in Quito, Ecuador, the capital city of Ecuador. If you journey to the Galapagos Islands, you'll probably travel through Quito. It's a nice city. It's a middle-income country. The city's growing very quickly. 5 or 6 years ago, the city leaders and the municipal water company were concerned about whether they would have sufficient clean water for their fast-growing city. And so they were making plans to invest in additional plant and equipment, gray infrastructure, so that they could clean water and their city would have all the clean water they needed. Well, our local TNC team knocked on the door of the municipal water company And they said, we have a different idea for you. And they made, what's interesting is they made an economic or business argument. My colleagues on the science side said to the municipal water company, we can save you money. We can secure the clean water you need at a lower cost than building this new plant and equipment. Instead, you should invest in nature. You should spend some money upstream in the watershed. You should change some ranching and farming practices, which we know how to do, and that will be a lower cost way to get the clean water you need. So the water company said, okay, we'll try that. We're interested in saving some money. So the water company put up a little bit of money, and TNC put up a little bit of money. It was very little money. And with those funds, we went upstream, and we changed some farming and ranching practices in a way that would work for those upstream communities. This only works with everybody's participation. But we did things like put up fences to keep cattle away from the river, new plantings along the river shore to prevent sedimentation, ditches to prevent fertilizer from running into the river, things we knew how to do, not that expensive, were in the interest of those farming and ranching communities. It seemed to work. So then we persuaded the local Coca-Cola franchisor to join our effort, and then we persuaded the brewer to join our effort. We had more funding, and it continued to seem to work well. You can test for water quality. So then the water company got the authority to charge all of their water users in their monthly bill an extra fee for conservation. Now, they would have charged an even higher fee had the plant and equipment been built. That was more expensive. So everybody's bill would have gone up by even more money. But in this case, everybody's bill went up by a little bit, but it got everybody's attention, and everybody came to understand, everybody who uses water in Quito, that taking some money, investing in nature, was a good way to secure clean water. By the way, that upstream watershed, this is important, is the Biocondor Reserve of Ecuador. So folks like the people at the Nature Conservancy, we would have wanted to protect it in any case. We would have wanted to protect that watershed as habitat for precious condor. But that's not what we argued for. Instead, we said, invest some money in protecting nature. You'll save money. You'll get the clean water you need. And voila, it worked. So remember I said this approach can do three things for us? First, people. Did we get more people on our side? Yes, every water user of Quito, and indeed everyone, became a conservation supporter through their monthly investment in conservation. Financial resources, did we get more financial resources? Yes. In contrast to the normal model, where philanthropy funds everything, here, a very small amount of philanthropy to get the flywheel turning, you can think of that as seed capital, resulted in this program right now where every month more funds are being put into conservation. If we don't mess this up, it could go in perpetuity. And then the third thing I mentioned was the dialogue between environmentalists and everybody else. Notice, TNC didn't come to Quito and start lecturing people and criticizing people. You should be taking better care of the condor habitat area. Some people might have supported that, but probably not very many. Instead, we listened to the people of Quito, in particular the water company. We understood what their challenge was, securing clean water. And then together, collaboratively, we solve the problem in a way that works, on a win-win basis. This idea was so elegant, that's around the time I showed up. I said, boy, we should, and being trained in finance, the high return on that initial philanthropic capital caught my attention. I said, we should be able to replicate this. So we recruited FEMSA, the giant Coca-Cola franchisor across Latin America, a company well aware of the need for good water supply. They became our partner. They put up $5 million. We recruited the Inter-American Development Bank, a kind of World Bank organization focused on Latin America, focused on natural resource issues. They put up $5 million. And then TNC put up $5 million. So we had a fund of $15 million. Sounds like a lot of money, but in our world, really not that much money. And with that, and using this Quito case as an example, we got to work replicating it. And soon we'll have 25 of these water funds across Latin America, each a little bit different, but always a variation of the same theme. Downstream users of water, investing in protecting watersheds to secure clean water at a low cost, but with many environmental co-benefits. I was in Colombia recently visiting one of these projects, and our partners in this case are Colombian sugarcane growers. I don't know if any of you have ever had the opportunity to meet Colombian sugarcane growers. They're nice guys. They're not anybody's definition of a tree hugger. They're big, burly guys who are sugarcane growers, but they know they need clean water. And when we help them understand that taking better care of the watershed, investing in nature, was a proven, low-cost way to secure their clean water, they became very enthusiastic supporters. So 25 of these funds. Imagine now the return on that initial philanthropic capital in the Quito Fund. But if I showed you these funds case by case, you might say, but Mark, they're still rather small. They are rather small. And so then you might challenge my opening premise, because I said we need to think big, given the challenges we face. But now the Nature Conservancy is in dialogue with the water authorities of Sao Paulo about investing in nature like this. And now we're thinking very big. If you should ever fly from Rio to Sao Paulo, and you look out the window of your plane or helicopter, you'll fly over this big hilly forest, and it's the Atlantic Forest. I never really knew about the Atlantic Forest till I joined the Nature Conservancy. Turns out it's one of the famous sad stories of environmental degradation. Once one of the greatest forests of our hemisphere, now sadly degraded, mostly through kind of ill-designed ranching schemes. And you see that as you fly over. But it's still Sao Paulo's watershed. And talk about a booming city. Sao Paulo is really booming. So now we're in discussion with the authorities of Sao Paulo, the water authorities, and we're just suggesting, and we have a lot of study to do, what would happen if we shift some of your huge annual budget in investing in your water infrastructure, and we shift some of that from gray infrastructure to green infrastructure? And in this case, that green infrastructure investment would restore the Great Atlantic Forest. We think we'll be able to show that that will be a lower cost way for Sao Paulo to secure the clean water they need, with many co-benefits. Beautiful habitat for various species, recreational opportunities, and pure beauty. That's really taking this to scale. That's what investing in nature can do. More people on our side, more financial resources, very productive dialogue between environmentalists and everybody else. Let me give you a second example. How are we doing time-wise? I got to go quickly. Closer to home. Go back in time to 2008, 2009, I guess, shortly after President Obama was elected. You'll remember we were facing severe economic challenges. So President Obama unveiled his stimulus plan. The administration was looking for shovel-ready jobs. TNC had some. We secured some funding for building oyster reefs in the Gulf. And we're really glad we did that work. What we showed was for $1 million, we could build 1 mile of oyster reef. Now, why does that matter? Fast forward to today, post the BP oil spill, the BP oil fines are going to be largely reinvested in restoring the Gulf's ecosystems. There's widespread agreement that the Gulf needs protection from storms and sea level rise, and also needs protection from beach erosion. And there's also widespread agreement that seawalls are the answer. Guess what it costs to build a first-class seawall in the Gulf? About $1 million a mile, same as our oyster reef. And we now have evidence of this. So let's compare gray infrastructure, the seawall, to green infrastructure, the oyster reef. Okay, well, when it comes, cost, same thing, $1 million a mile. Okay, how do they do on providing protection from storms and sea level rise? About a tie. Okay, how about the life of the asset? Well, the gray infrastructure, the seawall, like all man-made infrastructure, degrades over time. Depreciation, that's called. Our oyster reef, if we're smart and we take good care of it, not only should it hold its value, it might actually appreciate over time. But, of course, that's not the end of the comparison. The oyster reef is not a seawall. It's an oyster reef. It's habitat for oysters. Oysters are good for the local economy. Oysters clean water. Ultimately, oyster shells crumble, and they wash ashore and re-nourish the beach. Oyster reefs are also habitat for fish, good for tourism and in the fishing economy. So that's an example of green infrastructure, we think, dramatically trumping gray infrastructure. And now we're in a position to harness these government dollars from the BP oil fines and direct their investment into green infrastructure. Again, that's what I mean by investing in nature. A third example, and then I'll wrap up. The third example I want to put on the table just in the spirit of full disclosure. So shortly after I joined the Nature Conservancy, I was giving a talk like this, kind of, about natural capital and the need to invest in nature. And Andrew Liveris, the CEO of Dow Chemical, heard me. Now, I never knew Andrew before I took this job, and I don't know what you'll think of Dow Chemical, but in my view, Andrew Liveris is really a model CEO. On the one hand, he runs his company so that they meet their quarterly numbers, as a good CEO must, but on the other hand, he also takes a very long view, and he understands Dow Chemical is going to need to be a leader in the environmental space. And so when he heard me talking about natural capital, he challenged me. He said, Mark, if you're right about business broadly depending on natural capital, then that must be true for Dow Chemical. So let's figure that out. Let's figure out, TNC and Dow Chemical, let's figure out how much Dow depends on nature, what the value of that asset Dow depends on. Of course, with our accounting system, that asset, that green infrastructure Dow depends on doesn't show up on their books like the gray infrastructure does. But let's pretend it does and put a value on that. And then if that green infrastructure Dow depends on is vulnerable to environmental degradation, and it is, let's see what Dow can do about it. So the project was kicked off. It's a well-designed project. It will last 5 years. It will be very transparent, blah, blah, blah. I was really proud of it. So we announced the project. And then my environmental friends, including some important influential friends, approached me and say, Mark, have you lost your mind? This is crazy. Are you aware of Dow's environmental footprint? And I said, well, of course I'm aware of Dow's environmental footprint. That's exactly the idea. If we can show Dow Chemical and all the people who will be paying attention to Dow Chemical that it makes business sense to invest in nature and to protect nature, that's an idea that can really scale. And who better to start with than with a big company like Dow Chemical? But that was kind of the first response. Criticism from environmentalists, have you lost your mind? Then the next group I heard from, also critical. We have a lot of critics in our field, but it's good. We like our critics because they help us do our job well. The next group were firm environmentalists, more in the academic community. And they said, Mark, this isn't even a new idea. Academics like us have been writing about natural capital for years now, which is true. They have been writing about it. But what I've learned is writing about natural capital as opposed to doing something about natural capital are very different. So then it's time for our project to start. So our first pilot is in Freeport, Texas, Dow's biggest facility, biggest manufacturing facility, one of the biggest facilities in the world of any company. So I know this is a high-stakes project. We better not screw up. So we handpick a team of our best scientists, and we send them down to Freeport to meet with the Dow engineers they'll be working with. And then I don't go to the meeting. Everybody comes back. And so I call Andrew Liveris up and I say, hey, how'd the first meeting go? What'd you hear? And Andrew says, Mark, I don't think we had a very good meeting. My engineers tell me that those TNC scientists are kind of arrogant. They're not very respectful of the realities and the needs that businesses have to deal with. And I said, ooh, sorry, Andrew, let me check in with my team. Then I checked in with my team, the scientists, TNC scientists, and said, hey, how'd the meeting go? And they go, oh, we don't know if we want to work on this project. We don't know about those Dow engineers. We're not even sure if some of them even believe in climate change. And that was when a light bulb went on for me, to be honest, because I kind of had in mind, to be honest, when this project was being put together, that mighty TNC would come down from the mountaintop and show Dow Chemical the enlightened path forward. But that's when I began to understand that this was going to be way more interesting than that, and we would learn at least as much from Dow as Dow would learn from us. And that's what I mean about it's one thing to talk about natural capital, it's another thing to do something about it. Example, we went into this project kind of like our oyster reef example. We went into the project thinking, boy, Dow must be nervous about sea level rise, storms, extreme weather. And we had this notion oyster reefs wouldn't work there, but what would work are, restoration of coastal ecosystems. So once the project got underway and our two sides learned how to talk to one another, which did happen, our guys, the scientists, said to the Dow engineers, what about weather risk, coastal sea level issues? And they said, oh, yes, we are concerned about that. And so the scientists said, well, what are you going to do about it? And they said, seawalls. And so the Dow engineers kind of explained what they had in mind. And then our guy said, well, we have a different idea. How about instead we restore coastal ecosystems? We think it'll save you money and it'll even outperform. So the Dow engineers said, great, that sounds great. Show us the data. And we said, oh, data. data. See, that was another thing. We were very good at talking to ourselves about these opportunities, but we hadn't translated our white papers into the kind of nuts and bolts financial information, engineering information that engineers need for these kinds of decisions. Imagine if you're an engineer at Dow Chemical in charge of protecting the plant. Excuse me. Oh, that's just what I need. Sorry. Well, a Dow engineer doesn't take this assignment lightly. And about seawalls, it turns out Dow engineers know everything there is to know about seawalls. They should. They know what they cost. They know how long they'll last. They know what they'll do, what they won't do, etc. We had this lofty notion of restoring coastal ecosystems, but we didn't have the same data. That's the exciting stuff that's happening in this project. And then other things happen, too. Just because we're hanging out together. I mean, just hanging out, TNC scientists, Dow engineers hanging out together, good things happen. That will only happen if you mix it up. Turned out, we never would have known this, because that plant was being expanded, they were going to have to install new scrubbers in their chimneys to deal with local pollution issues. Excuse me. Our scientists had a good idea. They said, you know, we think maybe if you invested in reforestation around the facility, that would be a lower cost way to address those local pollution issues with a lot of attractive co-benefits. So Dow engineers, TNC scientists together went to the EPA, and we're not done yet, but the EPA is encouraging this analysis. The notion would be, rather than invest in scrubbers, it's hard for anybody to get excited about scrubbers, we will instead do big-time reforestation around this plant to address local pollution issues. Further, because of the way wind patterns work, it may be that some of the reforestation can happen in Houston. Houston's a great city, I'm sure you'll agree, but it could use some more trees. And it may be that one of the outcomes of this project will be, instead of scrubbers, lots of new trees around the plant and in Houston. And you can imagine all the co-benefits that go with that. So, had I been a little quicker in my feet back when I met Russell Train, that's what I would have said. But, of course, I didn't say that. But I would have said one last thing. I would have said also to Russell Train, my colleagues and I at the Nature Conservancy understand full well that it's not all about dollars and cents. Like all good environmentalists, we love nature. We think protecting nature is the right thing to do. That's what motivates us. But we think this additional strategy of investing in nature is additive. And again, it can get more people on our side, more dollars behind us, and enhance the dialogue environmentalists have with everybody else. Thanks for letting me prattle on and on like this. And I think now it's time to take your questions or challenges or hear whatever's on your mind. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark, for your passionate speech. Very
Thanks.
Enlightening. We have a bunch of questions. You guys have some excellent questions here. I'd like to start by talking about your time at Goldman Sachs. You nearly had a quarter of a century there. Talk about the different cultures between Goldman Sachs and working for a nonprofit like the Nature Conservancy, and talk about what you've learned and best practices you've taken from Goldman Sachs. And do you feel more effective being with the tree hugger group than with the banker group?
That's a good question. Well, first, I worked at Goldman Sachs for 24 years. I had a very positive experience at the firm. I worked with very smart people, passionate about serving clients, and with great and very demanding clients. So my experience was very positive. I know Wall Street firms aren't as popular as they used to be. They certainly bear some responsibility for the financial crisis, but my experience was very positive. About the transition, you know, in some respects, I mean, I've learned a lot about environmental nonprofits. Sometimes it's humorous, really. Sometimes I see my friends from Wall Street, and they say, oh, boy, it must be nice now. You can kick back and lead the good life at TNC. You know, I've never worked harder in my life. The level of intensity, entrepreneurship, just driven passion, you know, the nonprofit world is staffed and led by some great people. TNC is just one of those organizations. I respect them all. And so there's no real difference there. There are things that nonprofits can learn from the business world, and I think we're doing a good job at TNC about incorporating them. But there are things the for-profit world can learn from us. In fact, I was talking with my team about this right before the speech because I just was working today on a blog on that topic. But in the nonprofit world, It's a little bit harder, to be honest, because in the business world, you have tremendous clarity about what you're doing and tremendous market feedback. Remember New Coke? So Coca-Cola, probably the most sophisticated marketing company in the history of man, somehow decides that it's time to have to put old Coke away and come up with New Coke. Lord knows how many billions of dollars they invested in that. They announced New Coke with great fanfare, and lo and behold, it's a dud. The market doesn't like it. So they switch course fast, go back to old Coke. In our world, it's a little bit dangerous. We don't get that kind of market feedback. So we have to be very vigilant about ensuring we're testing to make sure to know what works and what doesn't work. It takes a little bit of money to do that, so it's difficult for nonprofits. But we now insist at TNC we set the funds aside to test enough of our projects so we can be honest about that. That would be the kind of thing the nonprofit world can learn from the business world. And it's a little harder in our case, so you got to make extra steps to do that. And then vice versa, what can the business world learn from us? When I was at Goldman Sachs, I was regarded as a pretty good leader and manager, and I think I was. In hindsight, it seems so easy. We had super clear metrics about what we wanted to accomplish, market share, P&L, and I had tools and rewards. I had year-end bonuses. I had promotion to partnership to dole out. In our space, people aren't in it for the money. They're in it because they're driven to achieve an organization's mission. And so leaders have to spend a lot of time with their team, one by one, to understand how they can best contribute to achievement of the mission and make sure people are optimally deployed, or they're on a steep learning curve, they're fulfilled. That's the best way we can manage our teams. And now in hindsight, I think if I knew that back in my Goldman Sachs days, I probably would have been a better leader.
All right. Excellent. Here's a question from the audience. Why has it taken so long for corporate America to catch on to the nature train? Is it fear, insecurity? What's been the biggest hurdle from your point of view? Because you have a special insight.
There's a great question. There's a couple things. First, we know more than we used to know. So, for example, the work we're doing with, in the book, we talk about work with Dow, with Coke, with Cargill, companies like that. But the science underlying our work hasn't been around for a very long time. So we know new things. Second, there had been a lot of mistrust between environmentalists and companies. There still is, unfortunately. And I think we need to be a little bit careful about that, because that's why I mentioned my Dow example. A lot of the breakthroughs come from mixing it up in a real collaboration. And so I think environmentalists have to be a little bit careful about vilifying bad guys. To be sure, sometimes there are bad guys, and they should be campaigned against. In my book, I talk about that too. But more often, I think, companies that aren't doing the right thing, they're just uninformed or afraid to reach out. And we should try to be drawing those people in. So I'm for the big tent. There are some bad guys. We need government policy to crack down on them. We need our friends at organizations like Greenpeace to go after the bad guys. That's important. We're not naive. But I think even more frequent than that, we've got to make it safe for environmentalists and business leaders and government leaders to come together, determine what we have in common, and try to get more done.
And how does the Nature Conservancy change policy? Do you have lobbyists in D.C.? How does that work? What's the process?
We do work hard on government policy. I'm glad you asked, because sometimes when I talk about these volunteer initiatives, say with companies like Dow, people think, maybe that can take the place of government policy. No. More important than all these initiatives is important government policy. Vitally important, and government investments in natural infrastructure. So that's the toughest part of the job right now. Sadly, things are, you all know this from reading the newspaper, a bit dysfunctional in Capitol Hill. We're doing everything we can at TNC, and we're pretty well positioned to do this, to restore bipartisan support for the environment. Sadly, environmental issues have become partisan. That's not in anyone's interest. So that's what we're doing at the federal level. Encouragingly, at the state and municipal level, a lot of good things are happening. So, I guess if you're in Capitol Hill, you can lose touch with reality and engage in partisan warfare. On the other hand, if you're running a big city, you don't have time for that, and you got to get on with facing reality. Sandy was very interesting in that respect. We're very involved both with Governor Cuomo and Mayor Bloomberg. Both of those leaders, Governor Christie as well, get the issues and are getting on with it and are rolling up their sleeves and working with environmentalists and other diverse groups to make progress. And that's encouraging.
All right. You said in your book, a carbon tax is the single most important thing to do regarding climate change. Do you see that happening anytime soon? And what is the Nature Conservancy doing in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, there's room for disagreement here, I think, on what's the best way to deal with climate change. In our view at the Nature Conservancy, and sometimes our supporters don't like to hear this, but we are a science-driven organization. We think the climate change threat trumps everything else we do. And so then we say, okay, it's just TNC methodology is if you identify the challenge, then you have to identify what is the best tool to deal with it. And we think in the case of climate, the best tool is comprehensive energy and climate legislation. We think if you put a price on carbon, and there are different ways to do it, that narrows the gap between, it first of all, discourages wasteful use of fossil fuel energy, which we should do. We should discourage that. That's the cheapest way to deal with it, right? Conservation. And then it narrows the gap so that the renewable energy sources that we really need to rely on can more quickly catch up. So that's our view. And again, bipartisan support for the environment, I think, is the most important thing. You know, the U.S., I think, needs to act. China and India need to follow. Interestingly, people always say, well, what about China? You know, visit China today. There's no mistaking that the leaders of China understand that dealing with environmental issues and climate change matters. And they're experimenting with things like, you know, what is decried on in the U.S., carbon taxes, cap and trade today.
Great. Yeah, we have a question from the audience here. Air quality in China, especially Beijing, is a disaster. How do we impact the country to do a better job? And are you engaging China?
Yeah, we're really engaged in China. It's, I think of all the countries away from the U.S., it's where we have our best presence. There's something about our way of doing business that resonates with China. It reminds me, I tell the story in the book, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. And I tell the story that when I was a kid, my grandparents were all immigrants from Eastern Europe, and so in my backyard, right in the city, urban limits of Cleveland, we had a huge garden and all these fruit trees. I spent my whole damn childhood weeding and collecting this fruit. I hated it. I was just a little kid, you know? Who wants those chores? And then suddenly, everything died, and I became environmentally aware because we had air pollution like China faces today. Now, indeed, China's is even worse. But all the trees died in my backyard, and the garden didn't work. That caught my attention. And then you'll remember, at least older people will remember, the Cuyahoga River caught on fire. Randy Newman wrote a funny song about it. We Clevelanders are still embarrassed. However, President Nixon was our president, and under his Republican administration, the EPA was created, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act passed, the Endangered Species Act passed. It was the breakthrough period for environmental legislation in the U.S. I think that's going to soon happen in China in dealing with local environmental issues. They know they have no choice. Will it be easy? No. They need to balance the need for economic growth to lift people out of poverty. They need social order, and now they need a third piece, third leg on the stool, fast, rapid environmental improvement. And they get it. We have to help them achieve that.
Right. Talking of cities, urban conservation is a big deal. There's a chapter on that in your book. Over 50% of the population live in cities today, and it's growing. Talk about the importance of urban conservation, urban forests, and green building in cities.
Yeah, we're really excited about this at the Nature Conservancy. We're newcomers in the urban space, by and large. When I showed up, again, I'm a city person by background. I asked our chief scientist, why aren't we doing more in cities? He said, oh, there's no particular reason why we're not doing more in cities. We just haven't chosen to do that. It just was kind of our style to focus on saving great places. Indeed, that was once one of our mottos. But we're not stupid. When we look at demographic trends, we say, boy, the people are in cities. We need to show people in cities why nature matters. And so now we're really excited about the work we're doing across the U.S. and around the world. One good example is Hurricane Sandy-related work, investments in coastal ecosystems to provide protection from storms. I tell the story in the book of work we're doing in Philadelphia with great partners. Many cities in the U.S. have this sewage overflow problem. Our sewers are really old and decrepit, and we have more intense storms. When these intense storms occur now, the rain comes so fast, sewers overflow, and raw sewage is dumped into freshwater systems. It's as gross as it sounds. And so cities have to do something about it. It's expensive. And so in the book, I call it something like making a city more like a forest. Old Mother Nature knows how to slow water down. That's what forests do. They capture the water and act like a sponge and then release the water over time. So in Philadelphia, we're working with the city and our partners on green roofs, on permeable surfaces, on more parks, all designed to capture water and slow it down to reduce pressure on cities. Again, the notion is this will be a lower cost way for cities to deal with this sewage overflow problem. Plus, they'll get all the benefits that go with this. You know, we know that in cities, the highest property values are next to parks. Take Central Park as an example. So we're excited about the opportunity to do more and more in cities. Oh, and I mentioned my Houston Dow Chemical example, too.
Great. And we have a question from the audience talking about water. Tell us about our water footprints. Is this something that the Conservancy will be educating the public about?
Yeah. In the book, I talk about all the work on footprints. I mean, clearly people don't understand how much water is needed to be used in all the products we consume. And we think it's good to broaden awareness of all these issues. And the answer, one of the answers will have to be, you know, consume less. So this movement to simplify and get by with less possessions has a lot of strength to it. But we're doing a lot of other stuff in water, too. Again, my water fund example, beverage companies are great partners of ours in investing in protecting watersheds. You know, earlier I said, maybe too glibly, that climate's the number one problem. I think it is, but a very close second are water-related issues. Climate exacerbates these issues. Excuse me. The only thing good about water issues is, in contrast to climate, they can also often be addressed locally, and it's easier to motivate people to take care of their backyard, and so I think that's encouraging. Excuse me.
Audience question, what strategies have you used in dealing with mining and fossil fuel industries, which are devastating the environment?
It's a good question. Sometimes environmentalists, environmental supporters, including teen supporters, don't love my answer. But hear me out, and then we can talk about it. There are certain infrastructure developments that certainly should be opposed. So there are occasions when environmentalists and their supporters should say no. But more often, if you buy my argument that these billions of people who want to enter the middle class deserve to enter the middle class, well, in order for them to enter the middle class and in order for them to have lifestyles that resemble ours, hopefully they won't be as profligate consumers as we are, but if they resemble ours, then they will need more energy, minerals, etc. So there's going to be more infrastructure coming, whether you like it or not, in my view. And so then at TNC, I think sometimes instead of saying no, we should say how. How can this environmental development occur so that people can be lifted out of poverty, but without bad environmental outcomes? The good news here, and we publish all our science on this controversial topic because we know it's controversial, and we don't pretend we'll always get it right. So we welcome feedback from our critics. But we spend a lot of time with our scientists understanding how developments can happen in ways that allow for economic development and improve the environmental outcomes. Here's one example. In Mongolia. Mongolia is a really interesting country. And it's, again, a place where TNC is well-positioned through fluky reasons, really. We just have a great team there. Mongolia was a ward of the Soviet Union, and so there was no economic development in Mongolia for the longest time. It was a nation of livestock and people who took care of livestock. Then the Soviet Union disbanded. A very young government had to suddenly fend for itself. And this young government is led by people who grew up in nomadic livestocking families. They get the need to protect their environment, I believe, in a very sincere way, but they also have a very urgent need to achieve economic growth, and the country is blessed with extraordinary mineral resources. One of the first players in Mongolia is Rio Tinto, a mining company that's not free of controversy, but actually does have, we think, good commitments to protecting the environment. They're our partner in the Gobi Desert. One of the world's biggest mines is being built in the Gobi Desert. We're partnering with the government of Mongolia and Rio Tinto to use our science to first minimize the damage of the plant. So using science to decide where infrastructure will be placed and trying very hard to avoid the most precious parts of the ecosystem. And then when impact is inevitable, using Rio Tinto's financial resources to more than offset that by protecting like habitat. And then we hope with the example of Rio Tinto and the clout of the Mongolian government, this is not a done deal, this part yet, we hope to be able to get other players in the Gobi, particularly Chinese energy companies, to make similar commitments. If we can do that, we think we can protect as much as one-third of the Gobi and have the economic development that Mongolia seeks. So it's not always the right answer, but we think often the right answer for environmentalists is not to say no, because if you say no, you're going to mostly be on the sidelines as economic progress occurs, and rather say how. How can this happen in a way that has the best environmental and economic outcomes? That's what we're trying to do.
You've said, Mark, that we all have an inner environmentalist within us. How can you, or how have you, and how will you, looking at the future, convert or help business leaders see that inner environmentalist and bring them to the table?
Yeah, I believe that very strongly, this notion of we all have an inner environmentalist in that. The reason I believe it so strongly is I'm like Exhibit A. I grew up in the city of Cleveland. I was outside plenty of time, but believe me, I wasn't like hiking. I was, you know, shoveling, delivering newspapers, playing hoops at city playgrounds. It was a very urban background. And I've lived most of my life in cities. My wife has a similar background. When we had children, I think in part because we felt bad about our own background, we wanted to make up for that with our kids. And we made a real effort to get our kids outdoors. First at local parks, then we visited, then we traveled. I'd read up on the stuff we were going to. I'm a little bit of a geek. We'd use guides, and I sort of fell in love with nature. That's how I got where I am. And so then I became very interested in, as a business person, in how the business can impact the environment. And look at me today. I lead the Nature Conservancy. That's Exhibit A. And the reason the Nature Conservancy is the biggest environmental nonprofit of them all is we didn't really start as a global environmental organization with such lofty goals. We were local. We were all over the U.S., but we were local. And we tried to protect local things. So we would appeal to people who didn't think of themselves as environmentalists. There would be some beautiful area that we wanted to protect. We'd recruit local people to protect it. We'd get that job done. As these locals became fans of the Nature Conservancy, they'd spend time with our teams. They'd get to know our scientists. And person after person fell in love in nature. We've had that experience with farmers, with indigenous people, with fishing communities, with ranchers in Montana, and now with executives and engineers at companies like Dow Chemical, Rio Tinto, et cetera. So, by the way, that's what's driving our work to be a bigger force in urban settings. That's why I wrote the book. We think there really is an inner environmentalist in more people, and we've got to help that realize. Sometimes people at these kinds of talks ask me, what can I do? We say, boy, we really need young people on our side. Do what you can as parents, as grandparents, and uncles and aunts to get young people out in nature so that we can keep this moving.
Right. It seems that long-term thinking is the key to this. You've talked about this concept of patient capital. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, it's true. The kinds of work we do doesn't happen overnight. So it takes a long view and it takes a patient investor. I don't think that's a huge constraint. I think lots of times people say to me, gosh, Mark, aren't these businesses that you want to work with always just focused on the near-term quarter? They are focused on the near-term quarterly results, but they're also focused on long-term results. And as an investment banker, I always thought that too. I don't think it's true that businesses are just focused on near-term results. Think about the great companies here in Palo Alto in this region. They're making enormous investments with very long-term payoffs. That's the nature of innovative technology companies. But at the same time, they're attentive to quarter-by-quarter results. So I think if we can use our science to better show business leaders how they can invest in nature, we can get a lot done. But remember, environmentalists have to get out of the ivory tower. That's why I told my little story about Dow Chemical. The white paper that environmentalists write for other environmentalists is insufficient. You got to mix it up with business people, with engineers, and with government leaders. We can't leave government out of this. Sometimes we want to, because at times like this, that can be hard, but we can't do that anymore.
Talking about mixing it up, here in Silicon Valley, a lot of the major tech companies have chief sustainability officers. Can you talk about that, how you're partnering with them, and how they can be effective in engaging business leaders who perhaps have relegated them to the basement, metaphorically speaking?
Well, we're four chief sustainability officers. We love them. They're great people. They have hard jobs. The good news is they're getting more and more clout. Just by way of example, the current chief sustainability officer at Coke is their former chief marketing officer. So you can imagine, chief marketing officer is a pretty big job. She's promoted to chief sustainability officer, B. Perez, and her office is right next to Muhtar Kent, the CEO. I saw it. So that's progress, and I think that's happening in more and more places. The chief sustainability officer is being elevated. And you got to start somewhere. For our projects, you know, we're not a consulting firm. We can only do so many engagements with the private sector. We're a humble nonprofit. And so we're very, very picky. And we'll only work with a company if the chief executive officer is very, very engaged. So any of the companies we work with, I know the chief executive officer well. I can call him or her up. I know that they're engaged. And so you need the CEO engaged. You do need a good chief sustainability officer. And then you got to take it from there. And you've got to do whatever you can to, you know, find near-term results so you've got evidence of progress and then take it further. And then these businesses need to be encouraged. So that's, again, where you can come in as employees, as investors, as board members, as customers. You can push business to do more. When I get frustrated is when I meet a business leader, including a CEO, who says, oh, well, what could my company do? Because I have not come across a single company where, with a little bit of imagination, you can't find these kinds of win-win opportunities. But businesses do need to be pushed. Sometimes they're timid. Sometimes they're a little bit nervous because in the past they've been burned by environmentalists. So we got to get past all of that.
And when you say push, how do you push?
Oh, well, the way we do it is, look at me here. We spread the word. We encourage you to do what you can as investors and as customers and as board members and as advisors. I go to forums like the World Economic Forum in Davos where our issues are taken very, very seriously. That's quite good. We really do respect the environmental activists who go after bad guys. In my book, I'm very careful to single them out for praise. They deserve it. Those are important roles. We push for government regulations. We're not libertarians. We do need strong regulations. Otherwise, the lowest common denominator will get away with abusing the environment. So all the above. But it's all going our way. I was talking to the CEO of Rio Tinto about this once, and there's a whole bunch of reasons they want to become good environmental citizens. But he told me one of them is they're in a war for talent. It sounds funny at a time when unemployment is so sadly high, and this is a bad reflection on our education system, as you all know. But even though there's high unemployment, companies are starved for key talent. And the CEO of Rio Tinto told me they're at a disadvantage because young people graduating from the best universities today don't think they want to work for a mining company because it has a bad environmental reputation. So they have their own incentives to do something about that. So there's a whole host of factors pushing companies our way.
Right, so it's deeper than just greenwashing then.
Oh, yeah, greenwashing, we need to be wary of it. We're accused of enabling that. I think it's going away, though. The world is so transparent these days. Anybody who thinks they're going to get away with greenwashing is crazy. Take BP, for example. I mean, I think their green initiatives were, by and large, sincere. They advertised about it like crazy. That was probably misguided. You should brag. You shouldn't brag. But anyway, they invested a gazillion bucks in all that beyond petroleum. And did that provide them any protection from misdeeds? No. We're past greenwashing. It's, again, it's thanks to your neighboring companies, thanks to information technology, social media, engaged citizens, the greenwashing days are over. You know, Rio Tinto knows that in Mongolia. Part of our work in Mongolia is we have outreach to local communities. These are rather simple communities of nomadic livestock herders. But they have a seat at the table. They have access to the internet. If they see things they don't like, they'll do something about it, which, of course, is a very good thing.
Great. So, audience question, how can we put natural assets in the world balance sheet so progress can be quantified for our bottom line policymakers?
Yeah, it's a great question. Lots of environmental leaders, I, again, in the book, I'm careful to say, the ideas I talk about really aren't new, and I'm building on the work of great people in the environmental space, in the academic space, and in the business community. Again, the Nature Conservancy is in a position to do something about all that, so we're excited about our contribution. But for a long time, observers, activists, academics, leaders have observed we need better accounting. We do. Progress is slow. Things like this don't change quickly. But I think the kinds of examples I talk about in the book, and I think books like mine and talks like this all help. And especially as businesses and governments have more and more positive experiences here, I think that builds momentum. And we just have to keep pushing for it.
Right. And talking about pushing and delivering your message, we have an audience question to talk about your ability to communicate your message and talk about the false dichotomy between the economy and the environment. Put simply, do you feel words matter?
Yeah, words matter, and we have a long way to go. I mean, the reception to my book has been pretty positive, and the reception to my little chats like this are pretty positive, but far too often people are very, very surprised to learn that environmental protection isn't at the expense of the economy. And so we've got to spread the word. Anything you can do, if you believe this, to help, please help. The other thing you can do is support environmental nonprofits. And here I'm not tooting the horn of TNC. That's not why I'm here today. I think we're a worthy organization. And I promise you, if you were to invest in us, whether your time as a volunteer or your money, we would do our best to earn the highest return. But I can say the same about all of the other environmental nonprofits I now know very, very well. They're very worthy. They're well-led. They do great work. They're supported by great volunteers. But we're all under-resourced. So anything you can do to help environmental nonprofits as a volunteer, as a donor, I think you'll find it fulfilling as you get to know these organizations, and it will make a very big difference. In the book, I tried to write an optimistic book. So in the book, there's story after story of really great examples of these kinds of win-win breakthroughs. In every case, there's a private sector player, a fishing community, an indigenous community, a big company. There's a government player, and there's an environmental nonprofit. Environmental nonprofits are really important. Please support them.
Great. Related question. Will the Nature Conservancy create podcasts to entertain and enlighten the public?
Yeah, we'll do whatever. We welcome good ideas. It's kind of interesting. When I joined the Nature Conservancy, again, it was a great organization. Great, great organization. I hope I'm doing a good job, but it was great before me, and it will be great after me. I'm pretty humble about that. But when I joined, we did have this motto, quietly conserving nature. And I said about that motto, that's perhaps an admirable personal quality, but as an environmental strategy, I think it's stupid. We should be loudly conserving nature. And everybody in our organization now agrees that. We have a pretty big bully pulpit. So we're going to do everything we can to get more people on our side. We call that building the constituency for conservation. It's really evident in Capitol Hill that we need that. So I hope you'll see TNC more often in the news, more energetic in social media. My book's an example. And we don't mean so much to brag about the Nature Conservancy. That's not so much our goal, but it's rather to help people understand that protecting nature is vitally important. It's urgent that we scale it up, and it's not at the expense of economic progress.
Great. We have time for just one last question. Mark, how do you keep optimistic about the future? Because disasters are upon us. Climate change seems to be accelerating.
It's a good question because, we don't want to be, I don't want to be Pollyannish. And at the Nature Conservancy, we really do try to be rigorously driven by science. And so, in a talk like this, I don't want to be a gloom and doom kind of person. And it's not my style. But there is, I said quickly, all these things we care about are in decline and our work is going to become more difficult. These are facts. And so in response to those facts, we've got to come up with strategies that can work. At the Nature Conservancy, and I think this is true for most environmental organizations or most organizations engaged in environmental projects, as you do this work, you can't help but feel optimistic because a little bit of work goes a long way. You can earn high returns in these projects quickly. So that's one. So, you do projects that work well, it makes you optimistic. Second, we've got information like we never had before. There really are scientific breakthroughs in understanding. And thanks to better communication tools, we're sharing that information broadly. So that's helping accelerate progress, and that makes me optimistic. And third, young people make me optimistic. Now, again, we need everybody's help to really make this happen. Young people today spend way more time indoors and in cities and facing computer screens than they used to. That's a problem. On the other hand, they get it. I have two boys in high school. They're like normal boys. I'm not going to brag about my boys. I love them, but they're normal. But I'll tell you, maybe they're paying a little more attention to this stuff because of my job. But they really understand these issues, and they want to do something about it. We've got to make sure that we fully harness today's young people so they can be the champions of achieving the progress we need over the years ahead. If we do those things, I think there's reason for optimism, cautious optimism.
Great. I hope you enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Mark Turchek, CEO of the Nature Conservancy and author of Nature's Fortune, How Business and Society Thrive by Investing in Nature. And thank you for joining us. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.
Thanks, everyone.